The Agriculture, Conservation, and Resiliency Committee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Buchanan.
Here.
Vice Chair Roth.
Here.
Ranking Member Skidmore.
Here.
Representative Abbott.
Here.
Representative Alvarez.
Here, ma'am.
Representative Antone. Representative Bartleman.
Here.
Representative Botana.
Here.
Representative Brackett.
Here.
Representative Usada Cabrera.
Here.
Representative Cassell.
Here.
Representative Cheney.
Here.
Representative Esposito.
Here.
Representative Hunshofsky is excused. Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Steele.
Here.
Representative Trunau.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
We have.
Members, and announcements. Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone to make sure you move your electronic devices to silent or turn them off for the duration of our meeting. Members, today we'll be hearing two different presentations, one of which will be discussing resiliency, and on the second one we'll be discussing invasive species. Why don't we begin with, we'll hear from the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission with Melissa Tucker, who's the Director of Division of Habitat and Species Conservation. She's going to be providing us an overview of invasive species in the state. Mrs. Tucker, thank you so much for being here with us, and you are recognized to begin the conversation.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. As you said, I'm Melissa Tucker. I'm the Director for the Division of Habitat and Species Conservation with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about invasive fish and wildlife and FWC's role in their management. Invasive species are of concern throughout the state because they can have a negative impact on our fish and wildlife, our environment, and our economy. More than 500 non-native species have been reported in Florida, although not all of these species are reproducing populations. One of the reasons that invasive species do well in the state is because of our subtropical climate. Many invasives are tropical, and when they're released here, they can outcompete our native species. Florida is also an entry point for many species coming in from out of the country, with thousands of animals shipped annually through our ports and our airports. The impacts of invasive species can be substantial. On the ecological front, invasive species can drive declines of native species through direct competition or through depredation and altering habitat. For example, tegus, as the one pictured here, have been documented eating alligator eggs and gopher tortoise hatchlings, and Burmese pythons are known to consume wading birds, such as the state-threatened roseate spoonbill. Some invasive species also impact human health and safety and can have substantial economic impacts. Quantifying the cost of invasive species can be difficult, but one of the commonly cited numbers is $120 billion that are spent
annually. Ms. Tucker, if you don't mind pulling your mic down for us a little bit.
Thanks. Oh, that's much better. Thank you. $120 billion spent annually in the United States. The FWC approaches invasive species in several ways. Preventing a species from becoming established is the most cost-effective option. Once detected in the state, we shift to control and to management. There are a variety of tools that we have available, depending on the species, but ongoing research, it helps us to refine and assess our management approaches and to identify new and innovative methods. Working with partners is critical to the management of invasive species. Coordination with partners extends our knowledge, our funding, and our expertise to better address the wide array of issues that invasives cause. Not all non-native species are invasive. An invasive species is one that occurs outside of its native range and causes or is likely to cause ecological or economic harm or harm to human health and safety. There are many non-native species that are not also invasives. Risk screenings can help us to assess the likelihood that a species will be invasive and to focus our resources on those high-risk species that are likely to cause problems. This process uses a biological data about the species, along with specific habitat parameters and climate parameters, to model the invasion probabilities. This information is then used to help us inform our other prevention and control methods. Another important aspect of prevention is enforcement. FWC officers, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, monitor our ports to identify when species are illegally imported into this state. Inspections are aided by the use of dogs and the ability of X-ray shipments, X-raying of shipments to identify the non-native species. Despite the efforts to minimize the chances that an invasive species will enter Florida through our prevention efforts, they may still be introduced into the state. Having citizens that can recognize these species and the risk that they pose is important. We use a wide variety of education and outreach efforts to increase citizen awareness and to help prevent invasive species from becoming established. And if someone has a non-native species that they can no longer care for, they can also contact us to help them safely rehome their animal. Some of our popular outreach activities have centered around pythons. The Python Challenge is an awareness campaign and a partnership between the FWC and the South Florida Water Management District. Last year's Python Challenge was a 10-day competition held during the summer that had nearly 1,000 participants from 32 states, Canada, and Latvia, and they removed 231 pythons in South Florida. The Python Challenge and the Python Youth Hunt are really sponsored opportunities for participants to remove pythons, but their real goal is awareness and to make sure that citizens are aware of the negative impacts of non-native species on the state. The Lionfish Outreach Program was started in 2014 to raise awareness about the impacts of invasive lionfish in Florida waters and to encourage diver involvement in localized control efforts. This year's Lionfish Removal and Awareness Festival will be May 15th through 16th in Destin. The outreach program also promotes the consumption and the commercial market for lionfish. Staff use a traveling outreach booth, participate in workshops and programs statewide. They focus on targeting new audiences with programs such as school lionfish dissections, and they also engage divers through training on removal techniques. Our education and awareness activities do lead to successful early detection and rapid response. Citizens that recognize invasive species play an important role in notifying us and our partners. The I've Got One app, which is also available as a call-in number and a website, is a multi-agency tool that citizens can use to report invasive fish, wildlife, and plants. The risk assessments that I described earlier have helped us to identify where the highest priority species are to remove, and then when these are reported, we mobilize staff to remove them quickly. An example of that is this Nile monitor that's pictured here. This was from Hendry County, a location in Florida that does not currently have Nile monitors, but we received this report through the I've Got One app, and staff mobilized and went out and caught it. And this happened to be a female that had 38 eggs, and so that could potentially prevent the establishment of a new population. Removal efforts within established populations focus on identifying areas where invasives are impacting our native species, their habitats, or human health and safety. Removal in these areas can mitigate the impacts of the invasives, even when eradication may not be fully possible. The removal efforts for Burmese pythons is a joint effort between the FWC and the South Florida Water Management District. In 2017, we aligned our python removal contractor programs and worked with partners to expand the public lands that they had access to. This alignment has been incredibly successful. More than half of all of the pythons that have been reported removed to date, that's 18,000 that have been removed, were removed since 2017 by python contractors. Tegus are another high priority species for our agency. There are four established tegu populations here in Florida, and since 2012, we, along with our partners and private landowners, have removed more than 13,000 tegus. This is a species that now has established populations in South Carolina and Georgia as well. Removal efforts for lionfish have led to more than 1 million lionfish being harvested since 2011. Staff encourage removal by private citizens and interest groups. When funding has been available, they've also used incentive programs to encourage the removal of lionfish. The Recreational Incentive Program reimbursed dive charters that conducted recreational lionfish harvesting trips by reimbursing for each diver that participated, while the commercial harvesters were reimbursed by the pound. Understanding the impacts of invasive species and the effectiveness of our efforts to control them are two of the important questions that research helps us to answer. FWC conducts and funds research to assist us in targeting our control efforts and to develop and use the most effective techniques. For lionfish, adaptive strategies are needed to keep up with the invasion and to encourage deep water lionfish removal. For pythons, we're currently working with the University of Central Florida to test a vehicle with a near-infrared camera system that's mounted on it to detect pythons that are very difficult to see and well camouflaged. Another ongoing project with the University of Florida and the U.S. Geological Survey is to use eDNA to determine the presence of invasive species. eDNA is the DNA that an animal leaves behind after it's moved through an area. The researchers were contracted to see if they could detect invasive Burmese python DNA near wading bird colonies, which they were able to do. And this highlights the potential impact that pythons might have on our native wading birds. As I mentioned earlier, partnerships and building stakeholder support are key components of invasive species management. We worked with 15 land managing agencies and organizations to develop the first Florida Python Control Plan. This plan provides a unified set of goals and strategies for combating pythons. We have also developed a technical assistance group to provide feedback to the FWC on issues relating to non-native fish and wildlife. Our staff are active participants in the cooperative invasive species management areas. There are 16 CISMAs statewide, and these are important partnerships that share information about invasive species. Invasive species remain a challenging problem in Florida. With our many partners across the state, we'll continue to focus on preventing the establishment of high-risk species and controlling those that are established. New innovations do offer some exciting opportunities to expand and enhance our detection and control efforts. We are seeing real successes with these efforts, and we do appreciate the continued support. And with that, I conclude the presentation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for that presentation, Ms. Tucker. Members, do we have questions? Ranking Member Skidmore, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for the presentation. You definitely have your hands full. And while there's been great success with the pythons and the lionfish, can you tell us what the current extent of the invasion is? It's great what you've collected, and the citizens have participated in collecting great awareness campaigns, but how big is the problem that's left?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Thank you. I think that's a really hard question for us to quantify. I mentioned that pythons are very well camouflaged, and so we don't have a really strong estimate of the population that's out there. So we know that we're having an impact, and we're seeing a decrease in some areas of impact on native species, but it's really hard for us to quantify overall how many across the entire South Florida ecosystem that we've removed for pythons. And I'd say the same is true for lionfish. Again, they can be very deep water, and so it's much harder for us to know what kind of impact.
Ranking Member, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. Thank you. I appreciate the answer. So this is great on the fauna side of things, and you definitely have your hands full, but what about the invasive plants? I think you may have mentioned plants in your presentation on one of the slides, but I think, if I'm not wrong, we have a serious problem with invasive plants as well. Is that under your jurisdiction?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Yes, it is. We have programs for control of upland plants and aquatic plants.
Ranking Member Skidmore with a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have, will you be giving us a presentation on that, or do you have the same kinds of sort of citizen participation in eradicating those as well that we maybe can share with our constituents and in our newsletters and things like that so that all hands on deck make light work?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So the early detection rapid response tool, the I've Got One app, that's where I mentioned plants. So plants are something that are identified there, and we do have staff that go out and work on those. There are a couple of high target species that we're really looking for, and we have OPS staff that are really dedicated to actually going out and doing the early detection and rapid response on those species.
Ms. Tucker, and on the plant side, as it relates to removal, how much is being done via mechanical versus spray application?
I think I'd have to probably go back to staff and have them pull that number. Yeah. We've been increasing our mechanical treatments over the last few years, but I don't have the number in front of me for how much we've increased it.
Thank you. Yeah, if you could get that to us, that'd be great. Representative Cassell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might fall a bit outside of your presentation, but I read a really interesting article the other day that talked about tracking pythons through their prey. There was a story about a possum that had been tagged and had a collar, and eventually they figured out that the possum had been eaten by a python and was using that data. Is that a potential for a pilot program, looking at releasing, because I know this problem is huge being in South Florida, looking at sort of releasing more prey into the wild as an effort to locate these pythons. Have you heard of that story, and is it something you guys are looking into, maybe duplicate its success in that situation?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So I did not see that story directly, but I can tell you that we have partnered with the USGS, and they have been taking snakes, tagging them, and releasing those, because the females, because then they go back to a breeding group, and so they're able to remove all of those snakes at one time when they do that. One of the other places where we've identified pythons in a similar sort of situation is we have several imperiled species in the Florida Keys, and so we've found some of our tagged imperiled species. We found pythons because we were tracking the imperiled species.
Representative Mooney with a question.
Thank you, Chair. Our question, what's the northernmost boundary you've found a python at this point? I remember I was told this in a python hunt, but I can't remember how far north it was because it was a little bit disturbing.
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So we do have pythons that are in Charlotte County. That's the farthest north that I know of. We've had incidental releases in other places that have been removed, but we believe we have a reproducing group in Charlotte County now.
Thank you.
Representative Alvarez with a question.
Thank you, ma'am, and I don't ask this from a selfish desire, but would a open season on these invasive species help where we would have, much like we do with our hog eradication efforts?
Ms. Tucker.
So you can take invasive species at any time, and we do allow for people to hunt on our wildlife management areas. They have to follow wildlife management area rules, but you can take invasives year-round.
Rep. Alvarez with
Thank you, Chair. So would then maybe a promotion of funding to get that information out there, would that help you more? I mean, tell me a way that we can help you get rid of these with more tools that we might have available.
Ms. Tucker, you recognize?
I thank you for that question. I'd like to go back and ask our team if we can put together a list for you to help with that.
Vice Chair Roth with a question.
Yes, ma'am. I always look forward to this presentation as a farmer in South Florida. We know that if any invasive species makes it to South Florida, they're going to find a wonderful home. The temperatures and the wildlife and the water and all that really provides an ideal habitat. So my first question is, as it relates to things like the lionfish, for example, obviously having some type of marketing program where you're encouraging people to eat lionfish and catch lionfish, that seems like a good cost-benefit ratio there, and that's what I'm kind of concerned about. So how do you evaluate what your program's doing? For example, isn't like lionfish like the gold star of invasive species because it multiplies so fast? I mean, so how are we going to get a handle on this? Of course, if we get a handle on it in a low-cost way, that's productive. You understand my question.
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So one of the things that we do with lionfish, because they are found in so many areas and they are, like you said, very difficult to control, is we really focus on those places where we're most concerned about the other resources. So targeting localized removal. Usually interest groups and private citizens are the ones that are doing most of that removal, and they're pulling them out, they're consuming them, or just, you know, catching and taking. But that's probably the most effective thing that we have right now.
Vice Chair Roth.
Yes, another question. One of the things I knew that they've done in previous years, particularly the Department of Agriculture, is trying to encourage tourists, particularly tourists, say, for example, that fly by private airplane to the Bahamas or other neighboring islands and then come back, that, you know, please don't bring your favorite guava, which you think is perfectly good. The trouble is it's got a fruit fly in it. So can you, is that program, is that in FDACS or is that in your purview?
Ms. Tucker?
That would be within the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services.
Okay. Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The last one, I guess, which is the concern I have the most, is I remember 10 years ago we were talking about one invasive pest per month. Do you have any kind of handle on what you know, all the invasive pests that are coming to Florida, what's the number per month or per year or whatever?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So as far as agricultural pests are concerned, I'm not familiar with that. Again, I think that's an FDACS question. We do have the non-native fish and wildlife technical assistance group that I mentioned, and they are helping us to look at what all is on the market from both the like the hobbyist industry and the pet industry, what might be coming into Florida, so that we're trying to get a better handle on all the different species that are coming in.
Members, questions? Ms. Tucker, thank you so much for that presentation.
Thank you.
Very helpful. We appreciate that. Up next, members, we will have a presentation from the Department of Environmental Protection, which will be given by Alex Reed, who is the Director of Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection. She's going to be providing us a little bit of an overview of the department's work on resilience. Welcome, Ms. Reed, and we look forward to your presentation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. If you'll just give me just one moment, Chair.
Take your time. You got there faster than I could have.
Thank you, sir. Chair Buchanan and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. As you mentioned, my name is Alex Reed. I'm the director with the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection at DEP. And although our name may seem a little new to you, our programs have been around for a long time. And I'll tell you a little bit about our history. So our office was created in 2019 with the Executive Order 1912. And this was Governor DeSantis's Achieving More Now for the Environment executive order. And in addition to focusing funding on improving water quality statewide, looking at some of the challenges we have with water quality, ensuring that we had good science and data behind our environmental policy, he also created the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection so that we had a comprehensive management of all of our state coastal resources. So by bringing together existing programs that had been around the agency, we were able to synergize those functions. We were able to share staffing resources between different programs and look at comprehensive management. So in total, we oversee about 5.3 million acres of submerged resources and coastal lands. And we also have about 10 distinct programs that also focus on different coastal elements. And then, of course, we added a new program to our office back in 2021 when we welcomed the Resilient Florida program. So not only did we get to continue looking at the coastal resources, but we also get to work with communities in planning and implementing projects that address flooding and sea level rise challenges. So I'm going to start and talk about the coastal and aquatic managed areas within our office. And a lot of people ask me, what does that mean? What are coastal and aquatic managed areas? What are those resources that we're trying to protect? So essentially, if you're thinking about seagrasses, salt marsh, oyster reefs, coral reefs, mangrove habitat, those are all of the coastal resources that we are striving to protect. And we can't take our eyes off the main source of some of the challenges, which is water quality. So we look at these two components intertwined and do monitoring, looking at both water quality and biological resources. So we have several different types of aquatic and managed areas. We oversee 42 aquatic preserves, one buffer preserve, three national estuarine research reserves, and then three different programs that all focus on a different component of Florida's coral reef. So I'll start with the aquatic preserve program. And the state established the first aquatic preserve back in 1966. And since that time, we've established over 42, totaling about 2.6 million acres of aquatic resources. The most recent addition to this list is the Nature Coast Aquatic Preserve that was established in 2020. And so in total, we have a really phenomenal display of inland aquatic preserves, coastal aquatic preserves, looking at everything from coral reefs to seagrass beds to oyster habitat to mangroves all across the state. These are managed based on publicly developed management plans and management strategies. And these are looking at the protection of that critical habitat and that very essence of the aquatic resource that is valuable to the state for the biologic reasons, for recreational reasons, for aesthetic reasons, and for we preserve these in their natural state for generations to come. I can't say enough about our partnership with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who helps provide funding through our Coastal Zone Management Program that helps support a lot of the initiatives, both staffing-wise and also with project-specific support within our aquatic preserves. Next, we have our National Estuarine Research Reserves, and there are three in the state of Florida. These are part of a system of national research reserves. There are a total of 30 nationwide, so we're very proud to be home to three here in Florida. And the core mission of the research reserve system is to integrate stewardship of the research with coastal training, which is looking at how policy in the local level can drive protection of the resource, and also integrating education. Our motto is we educate K to gray. And then also looking at research. How do we understand these systems and all of the value that they bring? And then how are we impacting those systems as they integrate with the urban settings that they may be close to? And so these offices are really focused on monitoring the resources, research, coordinating with researchers across the world. They maintain sentinel sites, and these sentinel sites couple the investigation of meteorological data with sediment elevation tracking, with habitat migration, so that we're actually, and sea level rise, so we're actually looking at the change in our coastal systems on a real-time benefit. So these are also the sites where we like to experiment with living shoreline projects and experimental coastal design. So these really are the research and development wing of our office. And then a big effort is working on education and outreach to the community, so that we can take the stewardship lessons that we use and integrate that into our local communities. And if you have not visited our environmental learning centers, I certainly welcome you to visit. They are all unique and designed to really express the habitat that they are located within. They're located in St. Augustine. That's the Guanatola Mata Matanzas. There's one in Rookery Bay down in Naples. And then Apalachicola is located in East Point. Our coral protection programs, and we actually have three different programs at this time that focus on slightly different areas of Florida's coral reef. Now, the coral reef itself is about 240,000 acres, and it spans about 350 miles along the reef track from Martin County all the way down to the Dry Tortugas. So we manage this in different sectors. They're managed in cooperation with other partners. The Coral Reef Conservation Program manages the northern reef from Martin County down to Biscayne Bay. And we manage this in cooperation with NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I'm going to say that a lot, so I'll probably go to the short form, which is NOAA. We also focus our efforts in Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. It is also managed with NOAA, and we partner our state management with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Now, if you've ever been to the Keys and you've dipped your toe in the water, you just entered the marine sanctuary. So it's a wonderful, very large expanse of protected lands, both managed by state and federal agencies. And then the Coral Protection and Restoration Program has been focusing in both areas of the coral reef to really try to understand the stony coral tissue loss disease that we first noticed back in 2014. And we've been spending this time working with researchers, working with rescue teams, working with propagation teams, trying to understand the extent of the disease, treatment options, and then understand when it is safe to start our restoration efforts so that we can have effective restoration at that time. And if you were listening to the governor's announcement about Executive Order 2306, he also introduced the potential for another program focused on Florida's coral reef, which is the Coral Reef Restoration and Recovery Program. And this program, if adopted, will allow the agency to work with non-government organizations and university partners and other propagation venues so that we can expand capacity for storing Florida's corals, propagating species, so that we have enough species to actually move into full-scale restoration when the time comes. A portion of this program will also focus on training industry specialists, that next generation of coral restoration experts, so that they can be ready for this effort when we are. And then there, I'd like to switch to some of the programs that we manage out of our central office here in Tallahassee. And these programs all partner in different ways with our managed areas. Our Florida's Coastal Management Program, also known as the Coastal Zone Management Program, is another partnership that we have with NOAA. And in addition to providing funding for our aquatic preserves, as I mentioned earlier, they also help fund several strong initiatives in the state, such as the Safety Flag Program that you see at beach access points. We also have a coastal access guide. We have an integrated data collection database that we've been working on for several years. And we also have two grant programs that provide funding to other state agencies and then local partner governments who can look at additions they can make in their coastal systems, looking at public access or living shoreline projects or any ecologically beneficial programs within the coastal system. Our offshore or outer continental shelf program looks at all of the activities off Florida, outside of Florida waters, in federal waters that have the potential to impact our state waters. So this may include geographic and geophysical studies, oil and gas exploration, aquaculture, or military operations. And we track through the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management any activities that could potentially impact our state. And then finally, we have the clean boating programs. And this is a stewardship-based system of programs where we reach out with marine boaters, marine retailers, marinas, and try to encourage good practices within the marine environment for discharging of marine waste or using chemicals within boatyards, for example. And this is all stewardship-based programs. This is also home to the Clean Vessel Act grant program, which allows us to provide grants provided by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to assist with providing pump-out facilities at marinas or within local governments. And then the beach and inlet management programs, I'm going to switch to a new slide for you. These programs have been around since the 60s. We've been actively managing and maintaining beaches within this state since, I believe, 1966. And the premise behind the program is to ensure that we have, that we maintain healthy beaches as a protective barrier, as that first line of defense from storms. It's also critical habitat for threatened and endangered species. And then it's also a wonderful public recreational amenity that drives the tourism in this state. So maintaining healthy beaches through long-term planning and comprehensive strategies has allowed us to address some of the critically eroded areas within our state. And for this comprehensive statewide strategy, we have five different programs in Tallahassee. We're looking at activities below the mean high water, such as beach nourishment projects, inlet dredging, and port expansion projects. We're looking at activities above mean high water line, so any development along the sandy shoreline within the beach and dune system. We regulate to ensure that we understand how that construction may potentially impact the beach and dune system. We also have a funding program. We have a dedicated $50 million a year that supports local governments and their beach and inlet management projects. These are the long-term planned projects. And then we also have field services to help us with emergency response and then enforcement and compliance challenges. And then we have our coastal engineering and geology team that helps wrap all of these programs together to make sure that we have good science and data behind policy. And then, of course, we have a new program that entered our office back in 2021, and it's the Resilient Florida Program. And really, that's the first time we've been using that word, even though a lot of these projects, our programs, have been focusing on coastal health and coastal resilience. This is the first time we added this word to our program. And since then, we've had overwhelming support from the state leadership in providing direct funding for projects to implement adaptations to the challenges for flooding and sea level rise. And we'll go into a little bit more detail with the Resilient Florida Program. So as I mentioned, it was enacted in 2021 and unanimously passed in both chambers. So phenomenal statewide support. There was an additional bill passed in 2022 that added some modifications to eligibility. It also added some additional opportunities for financially disadvantaged communities. It did require that some vulnerability assessments be completed to include the impacts of rainfall in their analysis, and then it required that we provide lists that exceeded $100 million annually. So we'll look at the components of the Resilient Florida Program, and there are really five key components. There's a planning grant component, then we have coordination with regional resilience entities, we have input and guidance from the Florida Flood Hub for applied science, we have the comprehensive statewide data set and assessment, and then we have the statewide flooding and sea level rise resilience plan. And they all feed into one another for that synergy for the program. So let's start talking about the planning grants. So since the program started in two appropriations years, I can proudly say after an announcement yesterday that with funding awards for 22-23, we will have been able to provide funding so that every county in the state, once complete with a study, will have a vulnerability assessment that will be compliant with the needs of this statute. So we're getting those grants out on the street, helping communities to complete those projects so that they will be eligible for implementation grants coming in 2024. Another component, the Statewide Flooding and Sea Level Rise Resilience Plan, has also been submitted to the legislature for you all to consider this session for funding. And this is a prioritized list of projects that we have evaluated based on criteria in statute and codified in rule. And it's a three-year rolling plan. So it looks at not only year one, but year two and three, so we know the length of the funding needed to complete a project. And what's really important is that once a project is on the list, it's guaranteed in statute to be fully funded through its completion. So there's no concern that the project will go unfunded to completion. And then one of the important things to note that any project on this list has done some kind of vulnerability assessment prior to being accepted. It may not be to the level of the statutory requirements for the new vulnerability assessment, there has been some analysis that identified a critical asset as being vulnerable to flooding or sea level rise. And then we're also working on compiling the comprehensive statewide data set and assessment. And this is, we have a contractor who's been reaching out to communities statewide and asking them to provide data for all of their critical assets and regionally significant assets and any analysis and vulnerability determinations they have made on those data sets. Now, as you can imagine, as we're just getting started with the vulnerability assessment that's compliant with statute, so we have not received a lot of data at this point, but we'd feel that we have, with the 30 data sets that we have received, it's a really great start. And as these new vulnerability assessments are complete, we'll start adding those to the statewide assessment. And we'll mosaic those pieces together so that we have a full statewide picture. We need to have the data set complete by June of 2023 so that we can have a statewide vulnerability assessment completed by June of 2024. And I would be remiss if we did not talk about the Florida Flood Hub. And the way I look at the Flood Hub is they are the center of expertise. They are that research entity that's going to help us understand statewide what we need to be using for sea level rise projections, rainfall projections, what kind of modeling analysis do we need to complete so that we understand what kind of challenges we have statewide and how can we prioritize those challenges statewide. So we're really looking forward to working with the Flood Hub and the partnerships and the work groups that they establish moving forward. So a lot of people have asked us how we prioritize projects. Well, the statute sets out a tiered structure of prioritization. So the heaviest piece of the prioritization starts in Tier 1, where we're looking at the critical assets and the regionally significant assets within that proposal. More critically assets that will be affected by a proposal or a project will get more points awarded. Also, what are the reduced costs anticipated by the implementation of that project? Because as we all have seen, it's typically tends to be less costly to address a problem in before you have a flooding issue or flooding challenge or a disaster. Tier 2 looks at the current flooding conditions. How vulnerable is that structure right now or in the near future? Is that project ready to proceed? Or are there added environmental enhancements to that project? We really give some emphasis to projects that incorporate green infrastructure or natural solutions into their design, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. Tier 3 provides points for having a local match or having a previous commitment with the state or for a project that will exceed minimum requirements. Minimum requirements are great, but can we do even better? And then Tier 4 gives additional points for innovation or regional collaboration or potential consideration for financially disadvantaged communities. So to date, through three different sets of funding, we've been able to award funding for 263 implementation projects totaling about $954 million. It's a really exciting first 2 years of the program. So the funding pots that go along with these awards include the fiscal year 21-22 Resilient Florida Grant Program of federal funds, and that's the state and local fiscal recovery funds, or also known as ARPA funds. We were able to fund 138 projects with that funding. And then last session, the budget included funding for $270 million of projects in state funding, and that touched 76 projects. And then we also received $200 million in in federal funds, and we were able to fund another 49 projects. Some of those federal funds did go to planning grants, and that's why we don't have a full $2 million listed up there for you. So what types of projects are we seeing, to put this in context for you? The majority are stormwater management projects, whether it's increasing capacity for stormwater management or adding projects to deal with floodwaters. We're also seeing a lot of nature-based solutions in living shorelines, which are a really great component given the mission of our agency to look at coastal resources. We're also seeing new or retrofit critical facilities. These can be anything from infrastructure facilities to community services. We're also seeing elevation changes or structure elevations and also seawalls. So I wanted to touch back just a little bit on green infrastructure because I think it's something that is not often our first choice. We tend to, when we see a problem, we tend to engineer a gray solution. Well, adding a green component and mimicking the natural environment and adding that into our man-made system adds the benefit of being able to provide ecological benefits while addressing flooding and stormwater management. So some of the green infrastructure types that we're seeing include wetland and forest restoration, adding landscaping to stormwater or infiltration, or adding landscaping to store stormwater for infiltration or aquifer recharge. Also adding more permeable structures rather than just looking at gray structures. And then adding living shorelines to our communities. So in the Resilient Florida program, we are looking at nature-based solutions as a more cost-effective solution to mitigate flooding and sea level rise. So far, we've been able to fund 37 different projects, totaling about $57 million. And adding these green components give extra prioritization points. So that's been a really nice to see those projects that combine a gray infrastructure project with a green infrastructure project. And just a couple of examples. City of Hollywood had a tidal barrier living shoreline project. City of Jacksonville designed a community living room model project, which created a green space that could also be floodable in the event of storms and excess stormwater. And then City of Punta Gorda has proposed the Tiki Point Harbor Walk Living Shoreline Project, and this was included in their adaptation and comprehensive plan. And it's not just the Resilient Florida program that focuses on funding for communities for green infrastructure. We also have opportunities within our Coastal Zone Management program. We can provide funding to state agencies and also to local communities to look at all types of living shoreline projects. And it's a really great way to get the community involved so that it's both a public awareness opportunity as well as a great amenity to that community. And I thank you all very much.
Thank you for that presentation, Ms. Reed. Members, do we have some questions for Ms. Reed? Representative Mooney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Great job. I love the green space. Love that ecosystem. I'm working hard on that now. But a question, because I, having lived the former life as a local elected official, the permitting process has a tendency to stymie some really great projects. We're not reinventing the wheel here. There's a lot of these things have been done on other areas in the world that we know have been effective and work, yet it seems like we are just stuck with rules and regulations. And I'm not minimizing how valuable permitting process is, because it is valuable. We don't want to do it the wrong way. But the timelines, is there any discussion? Because doing a living shoreline is a wonderful thing, but how long does it take to get it done? Does it take a decade? Does it take 5 years? I guarantee it doesn't take 5 months. So is there discussion between agencies on how you're going to actually implement these projects, which we are critical to the future of the state of Florida in a number of ways? I mean, there's tons. I'm working on a new thing. University of Miami's invented a cool 3D printed wave reduction system that then you plant coral on so that you can reduce and you actually capture the sand so you can let it disappear again off seawalls, a pet peeve. But being from the Monroe County and being ready to go, shovel ready, what's going on with the agencies when it comes to permitting is really the question, because it's annoying.
Ms. Reed, you're recognized.
Thank you. It's a really good question and very timely. We actually have a multi-agency team that met just last week to kind of start that ball rolling of how we might simplify the regulatory process for living shoreline projects. We're also looking at opportunities to simplify for restoration projects in general. So we are talking amongst ourselves, and we're trying to come up with solutions because it is a challenge, and it's because it's so beneficial to the ecosystem and it's so beneficial to the community, we'd love to be able to find a way to simplify that process and make it more, make communities more excited about incorporating this into their design of their projects.
Ms. Reed, and just on that subject, for the members that maybe weren't on this committee previously the last 2 years, maybe provide a little bit of insight as to when we begin to talk about some of these natural barriers, restoration of coral reefs, living shorelines, mangroves, the impact they have when we begin to talk about wave height and storm surge.
Thank you very much, and that question reminds me I did not touch on that very well during the presentation, so thank you for another opportunity. Our natural shorelines are natural protective barriers. The Florida's coral reef had an analysis completed by USGS, I believe it was several years ago, that determined that in a normal year, Florida's coral reef provides about $685 million in protective value for upland development. In a year of a storm impact, that doubles to like $1.6 billion in protective value when you have a healthy coral reef. So restoring Florida's coral reef is vitally important to us. We also know that that wetlands, a 1 acre wetland can absorb 1.5 million gallons of stormwater. That's pretty strong protective value. And when I've traveled around after storms, Ian and Nicole, when I looked at areas that had really strong development right up to the coast versus those communities that had a natural barrier before development, you saw that that natural protective barriers of mangroves or salt marsh or seagrass helped to dissipate the wave energy, dissipate the wind energy, and you had less damage to the structures built behind that natural resource. So it's really important that we look to keeping those systems healthy, restoring mangroves where we can, restoring seagrasses where we can, so they add that ecological lift and that protective barrier.
Thank you for that. Members, ranking member Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. Can you tell us what the current status of the reef's health is? I know that there's been a lot of efforts over the last number of years to improve it. Is it working? Are we improving the health of the coral reef to the extent that it can start to do what it is meant to do?
Ms. Reed, you're recognized.
Thank you. As far as statistics, I don't have that. I can get that for you. But I know that we have started to see the impact of the disease has started to plateau or to level off. We're not seeing much more increase in impacts from the disease. So we know that we're getting to a time where we need to consider restoration. I think that's been a big key concern. We didn't want to start restoration efforts before it was safe to do so. If we were still we didn't want to put healthy corals back out on the reef if they could then get infected with the disease. So we're starting to see that tail off, and we're starting to we're having a lot of success with the corals that have been housed in facilities and the propagation facilities. We're seeing great success in the propagation efforts and just maintaining healthy corals within our facilities. So I think when we're confident that we can start the restoration efforts, I'm sure that we'll be ready. We're also working on the genetic side and research and looking at how we can propagate corals that are integrated between those that were recovered before the disease went through and then those that actually lived through the disease. So that we have, hopefully we can build more breed, more resistant corals. So we're making efforts, making strides in the labs. We have some pilot restoration areas that are showing success. And now we're just looking for, trying to get more data every day so that we can be confident that those restoration efforts will be successful. And that's going to be another really key component of the new coral program that the governor announced in his executive order. A big piece of that will be planning that large-scale reef-wide restoration effort so that we can maximize success.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that. I know many of our universities have done tremendous work, FIU, NOVA, or NSU. Hopefully you're all working together. It's a little hard to know the threshold of where sort of DEP ends and your department starts, but one of the issues, and I see on your slide 8, you have healthy beaches. There's an issue, though, with grasses that are inland, you know, more in the rivers or intracoastal, and were part of the reasons why we had large manatee die-offs or whatever in central Florida. Is that part of what your resiliency program is looking at, or is that strictly staying in DEP different departments because it's not coastal necessarily?
Well, then I'm going to scoot back a couple, Chair.
You're recognized, Ms. Reed.
I'm going to scoot back just a couple more slides and start with the aquatic preserves, because a lot of the seagrass resources that you've been hearing about that have been in decline in various areas around the state are within our aquatic preserves. There are the Indian River Lagoon Aquatic Preserve, Biscayne Bay, Charlotte Harbor. So in each of those areas, our staff are monitoring those seagrass beds annually. We're also monitoring for water quality. We have long-term water quality databases so that we can try to understand the trends of the water quality and the trends of the seagrass health. So we are studying that along with our partners. We do a lot of monitoring with other state agencies and university partners and a lot of the local stakeholders as well, so that we can understand the reasons for the decline and then also looking to for ways for restoring those seagrass beds. Last year, we received an appropriation to the department to investigate the opportunity of pairing bivalve and seagrass restoration projects. So we are working with a consortium of researchers, universities, stakeholders, our National Estuarine Program members to look at restoration opportunities statewide and looking at habitat suitability of the different types of restoration within different environments. Because a restoration effort that may be successful in Indian River Lagoon may not be quite as successful in Charlotte Harbor. We want to understand why so that we can design restoration projects that are project-specific and habitat-specific.
Ranking Member, and a lot of the area of questions you're going down is also been covered part of it earlier today in Chair Stevenson's committee regarding water quality and quantity. So that could be a great one for you to go back and take a look. But if you have something else, I'd be happy to bring it up.
I did have one other question, Mr. Chair. If
you're recognized.
Thank you. Right before we talked about the flood hub, you talked about having a statewide assessment. And I'm just curious, would that impact flood insurance for Floridians? If you have an assessment of the state where we're more vulnerable for flooding, would that be something that could then be used as opposed to some of our antiquated flood maps to suggest or recommend for Floridians to have flood insurance? I know it's two separate things, but I'm just curious about what the uses for that flood assessment would be.
And I'm not sure if that's entirely within your purview, Ms. Reed, but you're happy to give it a shot if you like.
I will try. That is not necessarily within our purview. The intent of the data set and the vulnerability, the statewide data set and vulnerability assessment are so that the legislative body and the governor's office can prioritize state funding to the most critical assets around the state. So that's really the intent of what we're doing, is starting by identifying all of the critical assets statewide. And when I talk about critical assets, I'm talking about transportation assets, critical infrastructure, community services, and cultural, historic, and natural resources. So identifying all of those critical assets and then understanding through an assessment how they are vulnerable to flooding and sea level rise and at what time so that the state can prioritize funding to them.
Members, questions? Representative Cheney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. On slide 18, it looks like the nature-based solutions living shorelines doubled from one session to the next. Can you give us any background on that?
Ms. Reed, you're recognized.
I think what we saw here is for fiscal year 22-23, we had published an administrative code that was required by statute. And so once that administrative code was available and communities could look through the ranking process, see exactly how their projects would score, and then they understood that if they added a green component or natural component to their infrastructure, they could get additional prioritization. I believe that is what happened, that it made it more advantageous to use this amenity for your adaptation projects.
Representative Cheney, you have a follow-up? Members, questions? Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question about the water quality and what on slide 8 where you have beach field services. I found out recently in my health committee that there's actually an appropriation to the health department to deal with the beach water quality. So do you coordinate with them? Do you work together? Are you duplicating services? Are you just, you know, find they you decide there's an issue and they send out the information? I just was curious how your two agencies coordinate. Thank
you. Ms. Reed, you're recognized.
We will coordinate if requested, but our program missions are very different. Our beaches field services are assisting with construction, pre and during and post-construction inspections for activities built under the Coastal Construction Control Line program. They're also our first boots on the ground in the event of a hurricane, for example, or any other, we've been called when there are boat groundings, any number of reasons, but specifically water quality is not in the purview of this particular program.
Representative Alvarez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, sir. Ma'am, real quick, page nine, what is the difference between the 3 million reef protection and then the reef protection on for the 23 million? What are those buckets?
Ms. Reed.
Great question. So funding comes to the Coral program in a few ways. There's a regular recurring appropriation. Last year, I believe it was $8 million. This is the funding that we use for research initiatives, studying the coral disease. We also are working with our facilities that are holding Florida's coral reef that were rescued before and after the progression of the disease. And then the $3 million, and then the $23 million is cumulative over the past couple of years. And that the $3 million for reef protection and entire abatement is actually an appropriation that comes through the Division of Waste Management from that funding, the Waste Tire Abatement Program. And that funding has been used for remediation of the Osborne Tire Reef off Broward County. Part of that goes to removing tires, and part of it goes to our program to study restoration opportunities and also coordinate with the other functions within the Coral Protection Restoration Program.
Vice Chair Roth with a question.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. You're pretty impressive. You got a pretty good handle on the knowledge there. You seem to be fielding the questions very well. Got a couple of thoughts. One, the grant process. It's my understanding that the grant process has changed a little bit in the last year. My understanding was that the resiliency flooding grant process was initially only for municipalities and counties, and my understanding is that it's expanded now to include water control districts or water management districts. Can you explain that to me, please?
Ms. Reed, you're recognized.
I certainly can. When I think the concept for the program came about, the initial thought that was that we'd have a spin-up year or so to do some planning and then get a prioritized list of projects, and then we'd have funding. And then the ARPA funds came about. And so the first year, we were awarded $500 million in project funding. So that funding was actually appropriated in Section 3 of the statute, which was the section designated for planning projects. So there were some slightly different requirements for that funding, and that funding was limited to cities and counties only, because the intent of the statute was to get the planning funds to communities so they could get the list of critical assets, get that data set and assessment, right? So when the funding for implementation projects was funded under that Section 3, we were limited in that year. But we also were required to create that resilience plan, that prioritized list of projects that was completed in December of last year, of 2021, that was then presented to the legislature last session. That list was fully funded, and thank you, but it was fully funded, but that funding is eligible for cities, counties, special districts, water management districts. So that $270 million pot that came with that was eligible for an expanded list of recipients.
Now, follow-up question, please.
Vice Chair, follow-up.
So is it understanding then that obviously that we have the planning was done, the $500 million in the planning, and now we're moving on to actually resiliency. So the plan, in your mind, is to just continue with those type of projects, right? I mean, continue with water management districts, cities, counties, and everybody's now doing actual projects rather than planning. So that's the plan. So let me ask you another question, Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So this is probably going to come out of left field a little bit. Federal government has just finished Lake Okeechobee Hubert Dike program, and this legislature is appropriated, I believe, $100 million 2 years to help expedite the program and get it done by 2022. Being we're talking about flooding, I just thought it might be something you might know something about is the Herbert Hoover Dyke or the flooding concerns around Lake Okeechobee, if we had a dike breach from a hurricane, is that part of your purview or no?
Ms. Reed.
That is not necessarily part of our purview. We would be working with communities around Lake Okeechobee in addressing flooding concerns that they have. But actually managing the dike itself, that's kind of out of our program purview. But I wanted to be able to clarify something just very quickly on your last question, if possible.
You may.
So the $500 million or the $495 million that was appropriated under the Section 3 of the statute the first year, last year's funding, the $200 million in federal funds that were appropriated last year were included under Section 5. So we're looking at future funding for implementation projects to be eligible to that larger set of grant recipients.
Okay. Can I ask one more question?
Follow up, Vice Chair.
So going to, I saw you had under beach projects, you had protective barriers. You know, one of the things we think about, I'm a native of Palm Beach County, and we are blessed. I hate to say it this way, but Palm Beach County maybe is a little bit more blessed being on the East Coast because the water is a lot deeper. 1 mile off the coast of Palm Beach County, it's 100 feet deep, or could be. So the issue is, you know, worrying about flooding on the Gulf Coast, and you're talking about beach nourishment, protective barriers, you know, bringing in sand, trying to prevent wave action. Can you talk to that issue a little bit?
Ms. Reed, you're recognized.
Absolutely. The statute chapter 161 is the Beaches and Shores Preservation Act. It was first enacted in 1965, updated significantly in 86, and it charges the department with developing a comprehensive statewide beach and management plan, looking at critically eroded areas that need to be managed through restoration and periodic nourishment. So when we work with a community that's in a critically eroded area and they come together and decide to provide the local cost share, they can come into our program and conduct a feasibility level study to look at the need for the project in that area. It can start to outline the design of that project that is needed in that area, and then they can move into apply for funding to move into design, permitting, construction, and later monitoring. But every project, if we look around the beaches, beaches around the state are all different. Some are higher, some are lower, some have big dune bluffs, some have lower. So you need to design a project that's similar to what is naturally there. Or there's no benefit in making it much more substantial if it can't equilibrate into that system. So the program looks at, as I said, feasibility, design, construction, and monitoring to make sure that we understand how that construction performed, so that when you go back into the design of the next regularly scheduled nourishment, you can modify the design as needed so it performs within that system. But each area of the state behave very differently in that open beach and dune system.
Ms. Reedon, as it relates to data collection, it sounds as though, based on what you had mentioned earlier, we are on track for that June timeframe?
For the Resilient Florida
yes.
program? We have in-house all of the data that we know exists that can contribute based on the framework of the statute. Okay. Now, when we don't, there are very few vulnerability assessments that have been completed that meet the full intent of the new statute. And so that's why we're working with communities that have planning grants in hand and those that are about to get the new awards for planning grants so they can start that effort, start getting that data, and getting it in-house to us. But working through our contractor, we've been able to collect all of the data that we know of that is currently compliant with the statute.
Okay. Thank you for that feedback. Members, questions? Any additional questions? Vice Chair Roth has one more question for you, okay? He's promising you just one more, okay?
So, Ms. Reed, the benefit of you being here, the more you talk, the more we think. So it's you forced me into another question. Is part of the, I'm assuming, but part of the, that's a bad word, assume, right, that there's a protocol for figuring out when a county or city submits a resiliency plan and asks for a grant. Is part of that, a significant part of that population-based where, like, you know, you're this, if you had a breach, like I said, the Lake Okeechobee, there's not a lot of population there, but if there was a breach of a dike somewhere else, or the population impact, is that a significant factor?
It's ready to recognize.
It is not necessarily a significant factor. We're looking at a community level or a county level. Where it could potentially affect the prioritization of a project is if you have a regionally significant asset. For example, if you had a regional hospital, that's going to get more priority than a smaller community hospital, just because you have a larger service area, and keeping that facility up and running may, you know, need prioritization.
Vice Chair Roth has stuck to his word with one question there. Ms. Reed, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today, answer all our questions. You've always been great about that, so we're grateful that you came in and thank joined you. Us today. I also want to thank Ms. Tucker for coming in and for her presentation, answering questions from the members. We thank you both. Members, we're getting towards the end of our meeting. Does anyone have anything they want to share, questions? Well, Representative Mooney.
Chair, just because of the questions that were asked about Coral and the restoration project, because you and I are very close to Moat, but if anybody has any questions, come to my office and I will give you the A through Z coral restoration project, because it's much bigger than just growing coral and placing it on rocks. There's a multitude of spokes involved to make that reef actually work and sustain itself. So feel free to come pick my brain, because it's actually pretty fascinating. And
you've actually gone out in the field with some of this, haven't you? That's right. And there was also a great presentation this morning and Chair Stevenson's committee, water quality and quantity around this as well. So if anyone wants to spend time and go back and take a look at that, that might be of interest. And I also want to thank Chair McLean this morning. He reminded me it was Valentine's Day. Made sure I wasn't in the doghouse there. So happy Valentine's Day to the committee. Happy Valentine's Day to my wife and kids. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Alvarez moves. Without objection, we are adjourned.